My name is Danielle. I'm an alcoholic.
Danielle.
I was told to be careful because this thing's a little loud.
And I'll turn it up a little bit for you.
Okay. Wow, there's a lot of people out there. I'm super grateful to be here. Hey. You know, a couple people asked me, are you nervous? And I was nervous when I walked in here, and then I remembered this is my home. You know, PPG's been my home group for, I've been coming to PPG for about 9 years, and I've been heavily involved for the past 5. And people know who I am. They know when I'm not here. I have service positions here. And I'm just really, really, really grateful to be a part of PPG. It has given me, you know, insight into the book that I didn't have before I got here. So I'm going to do my best to encapsulate what I can in 10 minutes. So we'll see what God has for us. So, you know, when I was little, from a very young age, I felt very, very different. You know, no matter where I went, I didn't feel a part of. No matter if I was in a crowded room, I felt lonely. And I had this constant chatter in my head that was like, you're not good enough, no one likes you, you're not pretty enough, you're not this. If you had that, your life would be better. If you had this, you know, things would be good. And that was my experience until I found alcohol. And, you know, my first drunk was actually at 9. I didn't continue drinking then, but I did have an experience then that I remembered when I got sober. And so, you know, getting so, you know, it was New Year's, my mom, I'm 9 years old, my mom gave me a 1 wine cooler, and don't know why she did that, but she did. And I'm the only child there, so I spent the whole evening going around the room, drinking out of everyone's cups when no one was looking, and I came to, and my mom's standing over me in my bedroom, and I blacked out. And my mom's like, oh my God, what's going on? You know, I'm sure to this day I've never told her that. I don't think it's necessary, but she's probably like, oh my God, 1 wine cooler really did it for her, huh? So that was my first experience with alcohol, but I didn't start drinking until it was 8th grade was my first real drunk by choice, where I knew what I was doing. And I was at a friend's house. We had the plan to, you know, drink. And the minute I took a drink of alcohol, the way that it felt in my stomach, the way that it made me feel, I finally felt a part of. And you guys, I chased that feeling until I got chased into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because what alcohol did for me is beyond what it did for most normal people, right? People drink socially to have a little fun, to let off a little steam, and I drank for security. I drank to shut the brain up, right? To feel a little bit of self-esteem, because I had none. And so, you know, I spent years chasing that. I did not start a timer. Bummer. Hang on. We'll call it 3 minutes. So, you know, I'm not gonna get too much into what happened or what it looked like, because we all know. I rolled up into this deal and I was really desperate to stop. And, you know, my story also involves, you know, every single time I took a drink led me to the dope house, and that's just my story. There was a cycle right before I got sober, and then after my relapse, where this feeling of wanting to stop so bad, I was experiencing all the consequences and had for years, and I just wanted to stop so badly. And what I didn't know, and Chris has said this, and I'm stealing it for life, but what I didn't know is when I stopped that a timer started. And I didn't know when the timer was gonna go off. So it didn't matter what I said yesterday, it didn't matter how embarrassed I was the day before, it didn't matter that I, you know, fill in the blank. It didn't matter, because the timer was gonna go off and I was gonna drink again. And so, you know, that cycle went on for a long time. And I remember, you know, my boyfriend at the time, we would have these, because he was pretty bad off too, and we would have these, you know, big hoorah, this is it. This is the last time we're gonna get all the alcohol we can, we're gonna get all the party favors we can, and this is gonna be it. And that happened over and over and over and over again. And I really thought that I was changing my mind, right? I really thought that I was just overreacting the night before, or, you know, whatever it was, and I didn't know what I was up against. So, you know, fast forward, I end up in treatment. My parents are, you know, my parents obviously know something's going on. I've wrecked my car at this point. I've, you know, gotten kicked out of my boyfriend's house. I'm doing all kinds of crazy things to keep up my addiction. I'm driving the train from Fort Worth to Dallas because I don't have a car now, and I'm just desperately trying to keep this thing going while not wanting to do it. And so I, you know, I spent the last couple of months really trying to pull that off, and finally my parents were like, you need to go to treatment. And at that time I was ready. And, you know, I went into treatment and I was fully done. You know, I did a fifth step, I had an experience, I had what the book talks about as a burning bush experience. And it's not necessary to get sober and stay sober to have that, but that's what I had. And a profound experience where I was floating and the trees were vivid and beautiful. And I remember I was out for a run in treatment and I just noticed everything was alive and everything was like 3D for the first time in my life. And I ran into my counselor's office and I was busted open the door, and I'll never forget, her name was Carrie. And I was like, oh my God, what's going on? And she's like, what are you talking about? And so I described what I was experiencing, and she said, honey, that's been happening the whole time. You were just asleep to it. And so, you know, I had my first real dose of what sobriety could be, right? I had hope. I really, for the first time, believed that there was life after this, because when I rolled into treatment, I had pretty much decided that, you know, this was it for me. I didn't know what treatment was going to do for me. I had no idea what to expect, but at this point, I'm having this experience, right? And I get out of treatment, and again, I swore I was never going to use again, right? I never wanted to go back to that life. And I find myself in a relationship, right? Let me just say this. Like, the people in these rooms that have been sober for a period of time, they will give you suggestions, right? The suggestions are usually a good thing to take. So they're not just saying things to say things. So I had my experience. I got in a relationship. I'm in sober living at this point. I'm living in Austin. I'm loving it. And before you know it, I don't need a program anymore because I have this guy over here. And he makes me feel good and we have fun. And it's just not that necessary, right? And so before you know it, I have a beer in my hand with my coworkers, and I'm in sober living. And on a whim, I decide, you know what, this life isn't for me. I gotta go, I gotta get out of here. And so I move back home, roll back up into mama's house at 23 years old, right? Because I'm out of options. And the one drink led me to the dope house. It doesn't look any different for me, and I'm very clear about that today. I take the drink and the drink takes me. I have no idea what's gonna happen next. Absolutely zero idea what's gonna happen next. And so this is where it really gets painful, because now I've experienced AA, I've experienced sobriety, I know there's something different, right? And I'm going to AA meetings desperate. I don't want to do this anymore. Like, I want what you have, right? And I show up to these meetings and I get a desire chip, and then I leave the meeting and I'm back at the bar, right? How did I get here? And I do this over and over and over again, and sometimes I'm crying on the way there, trying to talk myself out of it. But what I didn't understand, even going through treatment, even being with a sponsor, is what I was up against. I didn't know that I was up against something that made me bodily and mentally different. I had no clue, which is the scary part about being in the rooms, because a lot of people I know, and I've taken on sponsees who have years of sobriety and cannot tell me what it means to be an alcoholic. And so when, you know, finally I had this little, you know, I think God cracks the windows for us sometimes, and we have a very small window of opportunity to jump through. And that happened for me, and I ended up back in Austin. And, you know, I wish that I could sit up here and tell you that even though I had all these experiences of being miserable and wanting what you had and watching all these people with the lights on and how glamorous their life looked and how peaceful they looked, I wish that I could tell you that even after that experience that I rolled up in here and I did everything I was supposed to, and I didn't. Because here's the other part I didn't understand. is that in the third steps, it's a second surrender, right? At this point, I understand that alcohol is a byproduct of what's really going on, right? I have a spiritual malady, and this is a thing that I have used to fix it, but I'm bodily and mentally different, right? So I'm screwed. But then it goes on to tell me that my problem is me, right? And so in step three, I'm supposed to surrender my life to God, right? If it was just alcohol and drugs, then none of us would have to do this, right? But what happens is I take the alcohol and drugs away, and then it's whack-a-mole, right? Then it's relationships. Then it's food. Then it's fill in the blank, right? And that just keeps happening over and over and over again. And so, you know, I'm so grateful. I've been working with the same woman for, you know, my entire sobriety. And she was a woman with a solution. And even though she had the solution, I drug my feet with it for a long time. Ended up, you know, knee deep in all these outside issues that nearly took me out. Because this disease is out to kill me and get me in any single way that it can. And so I spent years in Alcoholics Anonymous doing a little bit of work, getting a little bit of relief, feeling a little bit of the promises, and then resting on my laurels, right? And this cycle went on and on and on and on again, until I came up against that place where the jumping off place, right? Where it's like, okay, am I gonna pick up the spiritual tools, or am I gonna go onto the bitter end? Because that's my choice right now. And I remember calling her and getting honest for the first time about the things that I had been dishonest about and all of the, you know, all the secrets I had and all of the things that I wasn't willing to talk about because I had so much shame around. And that was my first moment into the program for real. And, you know, even then, I don't know what it is, but I am a very stubborn person. And so, you know, it took me a couple of years till I really put both feet in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that doesn't look like working the steps every now and then, doing a 10 step here and there, working with sponsees, you know. It looks like a lot of things. It looks like investing in the steps. It looks like continuously staying on top of 10, 11, and 12. It looks like going through a body of work every year. It looks like sponsoring women. It looks like having a commitment, having a home group. The home group knowing that who you are and when you're not there, right? I got tired of being the woman that would watch you and wanted so desperately what you had, right? I desperately wanted what you had, and I wasn't willing to do what you did. And, you know, I think the pain tolerance the road gets narrower and narrower today. And so my ability to not 10 step or to sit on a piece of inventory or, you know, I don't have the luxury anymore. And I'm grateful for that. I'm really grateful for that. Let's see what we got here. I'm burning up. Are y'all hot?
Yeah.
I'm sweating. I'm like, am I that nervous? Oh my God, okay. So we just have a couple more minutes. And I just, you know, I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous today. Like, I am the woman that people look at and want to be today. And I didn't get there by chance. I got there because I did what the women I was watching did. And, you know, when I think about the relationships and the things that I have today, you know, like mend relationships with my family. You know, I'm starting to be involved with my adopted family for the first time in my life. All of these gifts are a direct result of the continuation of the work of the steps. And so I'm really grateful that I got to come up here and talk a little bit. I know it's just the appetizer to the real dinner tonight. So thank you guys so much. And thank you, PPG. You guys are amazing. I hope that some of you guys come back who don't come here. So thank you.
I gotta go give it to her.
Oh, Danielle's spectacular. 10 minutes is not easy. Oh, God dang, that was so fantastic. It's my honor and privilege to introduce my friend who Charlie and I have been dear friends of the Marinellis for a long, long time. And I did a little bit of manipulating trying to get Peter to get Charlie to get his sponsor, and it didn't work. I love these guys. But see, I love people in AA that'll let you do that. You know, but some people are like, are you controlling? Yes, I'm controlling. Call it whatever you want. I love these two with all my heart.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Peter, recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And first things first, congratulate the group on your anniversary. Keeping the doors open. I've heard about this group. We have, my home group does, I think, a similar format on Monday night. I know about Myers down and over and up and down and sideways to Dallas, wherever Dallas is. They do that. So I've heard a lot about you guys. It's a treat for me to be here. I want to thank Miss Katie and he's somewhere floating around here who manipulated to get me here. What's his name?
Brian.
Yeah, there he is. And so thank you for having me and taking good care of me. My wife and I get to travel a whole bunch. And a lot of it is together. Either I'm speaking and she's roadie, or she's speaking and I'm roadie, and sometimes we do these things together. And I would have never seen that or saw that on my entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous, where I was in a place of fighting for survival, fighting for my life. And so God has given me a great walk here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my job is to uphold the traditions as well as the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. June 23rd, 1988 has been a loving God separating me from alcohol. I'm very grateful for this gift of sobriety. I'm very grateful to remember good standing and try to practice these principles in all my affairs when others around me are not. I have a home group called Alcoholics from God in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and I love going there. It looks like a little conference when you walked in. Wonderful trusted service. It's just a treat for me to be there on Thursday night. I do have a sponsor. His name is Bob Azanz out of St. Paul, Minnesota, and I sponsor about a dozen men, and they all know I'm their sponsor, and if you're around here a while, that usually helps. So I'm grateful for the many things God has given me. You know, I've shared this from a million podiums before we get into the what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. The current stuff. And some of the current stuff, because I'm either growing or going, some of the current stuff has been with me for a while, but it's good. It's not only current looking at, okay, where are more holes in the armor, but it's these new awakenings, new aha moments, these new God winks, these new revelations that are transforming that we get as we plow the field and chop wood and carry water. We keep the ground fertile. God has room to do some growing, and they kind of burst upon me. And most of these things happen early in the morning. I'm an early riser. I mean, you know, getting up a little after 5 as I slept in. I mean, that's how it is. So I might be just getting old. I'm not sure. But I'm up really early doing prayer, meditation, and reading lots of books, and I do a lot of my stuff then. It's a very sacred time for me, and that's usually when God, not all the time, and I can't plan it, but just seems to give me this moment, and you get the truth is true until we discover a new truth, and I see something clear for the first time. It goes high def, or sometimes it just gets dropped in my lap. Mariano says, God will drop something on your heart. And when that stuff happens, I don't need to write it down. It becomes internalized in here. Mark Houston was my sponsor for a while, and he used to say, do not read spiritual books. Work with them. There's a big difference. Because that book, like this book, needs to be internalized. I remember there was a gentleman out of Colorado, John P., and he said to me one day, it was a trick question, he said, could you ever take someone through the 12 steps without having a big book between you? So I did Star Pupil. I says, oh, absolutely not, Don. He's a key coming back. I says, what do you mean? And he was making a point that this book needs to be in here. So if I'm on the fly meeting a drunk, I can work with them right now. I don't need to remember what page this says it because it's who I am now. And we do the mechanics long enough. It's like my name. I remember it. So great lessons I learned. But I was saying, longer I'm sober and the older I'm getting, new things have been brought to light for me. And the first one is that Alcoholics Anonymous, and I speak for myself, I'm not a model or an example of AA, I'm just here to tell my story, that this thing that we're in, this journey, this spiritual walk that I'm on, if I could be so bold, as all of us are on, is really about relationships. In fact, the first bedevilment is having trouble in personal relationships. It wouldn't be first if it wasn't important. The book is so precise, they would have put it eighth or ninth or not mention it at all. But it's the top one. How am I doing in personal relationships with others, starting with God? I mean, what does that look like currently, as recent as maybe an hour ago or this morning? There's a woman called Carol LeMay. She says, who is your God? Who are you praying to? What does it look like? What does it sound like? Am I praying with my mind, or am I praying with my soul? Am I petitioning God, or am I listening to God? Do I think if I pray hard enough and memorize the book long enough and really got the book memorized so good I can quote everything, that somehow my prayers would convince God to listen to me? Because I have found, no matter what I say, no matter what I do, I cannot command the Spirit to do anything. But yet be in a place of openness and willing to do what the Spirit tells me to do, because the ears are open. We get to a place in here, at least I have, and I love to tell you do this every day, but I don't, because I'm broken and flawed. Sometimes I'm just full of me. But what God does, as we talk about this transformation, this spiritual revolution, He closes the ears to the mind and open up the ears to the soul. For the longest time, I would hear from the mind, I would speak from the mind, I would see from the mind. Everything operated out of the mind and the external world only. And what begins to happen is self starts to die, and I start to listen to the soul, because that's always right. It knows where to go, what to say, what to do, and how to be. I'm traveling light. When I'm in my mind, I'm not traveling light. I've often heard in AA, we tell people, bring the body and the mind will follow. Now, I want to get the guy who invented that and have a talk with him. It's insane. Why would you want my mind showing up at your group anniversary? And quite frankly, I don't want to know about your mind either. It is the troublemaker. If you think about from the time you woke up this morning till right now, how much dialogue, how much narrative was going on that we listen to and we act out of that. And that thought life creates my current reality. I'm traveling heavy. See, if a new guy sat with me and says, hey, here's what's going on, I say, hey, man, that's your thoughts, man. It's nonsense. Don't pay, you know, just dump it. But when they're mine, it's true, because they're mine, and that gives it power and it owns me. I mean, I remember sitting with Mark, bless his heart, a long time ago, and says, Mark, I have all these thoughts. And he says, you don't have thoughts. They have you. Because if you had thoughts, you can get rid of them. But they land on you and they own you and they take you wherever they want to go. And the only power that's going to get me unhooked from that is a power called God. My future of my security cannot be apart from God. Page 43 talks about I'm 100% hopeless apart from divine help. These are clear-cut messages that without God, I'm drunk. And if I'm not drunk, I'm untreated. My alcoholism doesn't come in a bottle of whiskey. My alcoholism gets a life by taking mine. One day God's going to give me my last breath. When that day happens, let me die with alcoholism and not from it. Because I can die from alcoholism without ever putting a drink in me. Mm-hmm. Or any non-conference approved dry gun. I'll blow my brains out. And I will destroy people's lives, because alcoholism really doesn't care about any of us or our loved ones. It just doesn't. That's what it does. All I have to do is take a look at what brought me in here. That train is ready to pull out of the station if I give it enough time. So it's about relationships with God and relationships with others. How am I doing with others, in not only in home group, but just, and not only AA, but just people? How much tension do I feel when I see John or Mary walk in the room? And you get that little thing, oh, there they are. Oh my God, they misquoted the big book. Let's have a meeting. They were supposed to do step 3 and they missed it. Uh-oh. Call the AA SWAT team. Or my neighbors. How much tension do I have in my head about someone? How much gossip and slandering and critiquing do I do of other people? How do I get involved with gossip? Because I like to gossip about people. It raises me up. How much I love drama. But if I don't have drama, I'll look for your drama. And if we don't have drama, we will invent some drama. By the time the meeting starts, we'll be in the middle of it. And then we walk into home group, how you doing? I'm wonderful. I'm doing great. Yeah. Anyone drive here alone in their car tonight? Anyone drive alone in their car? Okay, you're all lying to me. Because if you think about the ride over here, I'll lay us from here to Vegas, you were in dialogue with about 45 people in the back seat. Arguing with some of them. All that stuff. And when you leave the meeting, they're in the car waiting. Let's go. Have you ever awakened first thing in the morning and as soon as you open your eyes, you're in a heated argument with somebody who died 20 years ago? As soon as you open up your eyes, hit the ground, you're like, you're just grinding at it already. So how am I doing with that kind of stuff? Scripture says that God will give us an equal measure of faith. And I'm supposed to use that soberly. An equal measure of faith. He didn't give more to him and less to her. An equal measure of faith. What I do with that is up to me. Am I cultivating that faith? Am I bringing it to a newcomer, not afraid that God's going to scare them out? Am I talking about God freely? Am I around people who are talking about God, who are believers, not only in this book and in our beautiful fellowship, our sacred fellowship, but about God, where all good things come from? How am I doing in my personal relationships? The other thing I've learned that was born out of that, we talk about, I did for a long time, we talk about God's love. We always hear it in AA. We talk about God's grace. We talk about God's power. We talk a lot about that. Came to believe that a power greater than myself. I mean, over and over and over again. What about God's mercy? Am I going to God for his mercy? Because I have found with all the stuff that's been going on in AA since we began, and people looking to rewrite stuff and change stuff and move this and change that and all the stuff that goes on, somehow God's mercy keeps the doors open and the coffee on and the lights on, because God's going, where else are you people going to go? I'll throw some more mercy at you. How many of us in this room acted drunk, went on that spree and remained sober and came back in and jumped back in the saddle and kind of got going again? I mean, I don't deserve any of this. It's God's love, God's power, but God's mercy. Yeah. The other thing I've learned, and this is really near and dear to me, I lost my dad in July, and he was my hero. We never got along when I was a kid. I get sober, and suddenly relationships get better. And he and I got real close, and he was my hero. And I quite frankly, like a little kid, I thought my dad would be around forever. And he went from like 6'6", 1 to 220 down to like 115 pounds before he passed. And I realized the value of this thing that we have called life. What am I doing with it? How am I treating myself? Am I getting soul food? Am I taking care of the soul, which allows me to take care of this body? How am I doing? Because I'm here for a vapor. I'm in and out. Even if we live to a ripe old age of 100, when we get there, we say, that's too fast. We're in and out. What am I doing with this thing called life? It is so fragile. There's no guarantee I'm going to be here tomorrow morning. And I said, well, I'll take care of that amends tomorrow. I'll fix that relationship tomorrow. I'll give John or Mary a call tomorrow. I'll pray tomorrow, 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 and tomorrow's today, and it's too late. It's so fragile. And so is my sobriety. I don't care, and I speak for myself, how many meetings a week I go to, how many inventories I write, how many times I've gone through the steps, how many people I sponsor, how much coffee I make, I have a DCM commitment, I'm a GSI, all the stuff. At the end of the day, I still have a thinking mind that wants to get in there and give me space between me and God. You don't need to do this. You can cut a corner on there. You can skip that meeting. You can get away with a little bit of this, and you can get away with a little bit of that, and suddenly I got plaque on the soul, and I lose my way. And for me to lose my way, there's a default button that says double vodka, because once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I don't care how recovered I think I am. I still got that gorilla in the cage back there, sleeping. It doesn't take much, a couple of nudges, and he wakes up. And then you see it, but I don't. Because I think I'm okay. These were awakenings for me. When a book talks about having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the 12 steps, we automatically assume a few things are going to happen. But what about emotional sobriety? What does that look like going live? What kind of awakenings am I having? What do my relationships look like? What does this walk really look like when there's no AAs around? Am I an AA angel and a house devil? I got a benefit, and I'm sure a bunch of you guys can identify, that my wife and I, she's sober almost as long as I am, and we get to travel, but we get to pray and talk about that. So in the morning when we're both praying, Marion calls it as Pete sees it. She's, how does Pete see it today? And we have this little thing we talk about, or maybe something happened in a prayer or meditation, a little awakening. It's a great way to start our day. None of that was on the horizon for me when I got sober. In fact, in June of 1988, I'm from New York. You can tell I'm not from Austin by the way I speak. I say I love you, it sounds like a threat sometimes, I know. Christmas time at the Marinelli household sounds like The Sopranos, trust me. But in June of 88, I was living in Lower Manhattan, an area called Alphabet City, and it was a really sordid spot. It was Avenue A, B, C, and D. And it was a place, the people who lived there didn't have the resources to move out. They called them the projects, that's where they lived. And then there were people like me. You had the winos, you had the junkies, the crack scene hit. It was a bad place to be. A lot of violence, a lot of crime, just bad stuff going on. And that's where I was. Now, how I landed there is a direct result of the drinking and doing non-conference food dry goods, and the trapdoors have trapdoors, and you wake up, here I am, and this is the life. But I took up residency in the back of an abandoned building, and that's where I was living. I remember it was just awful, and I was way in the back behind the old metal radiators. That's where I kind of hunkered down back there. I was so afraid, and it just smelled awful. And occasionally a wino would drift in, or a dope fiend would go shoot up in the corner and nod out. He's one of us, so he's okay. You know, as long as the police don't show up, and they never did. And the only thing that illuminated that hallway was a street light outside, give a little daylight through the crack in the glass. That was about it at night. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm on a path of illumination. The 12 steps illuminate the path. What a conversion. But there I was, you know, homeless for a while and panhandling, and I was one of those bums that you would see on the street. I was not welcome anywhere. And I wasn't a gun guy, I wasn't a rageful or a tough guy out there. I couldn't get out of my own way. I was always in trouble, but I wasn't like a threat. I wasn't going to intimidate you if you ran into me on the street. In fact, in 1988, I was down to 130 pounds. I'm a little over 200 right now. And I'm running around with hepatitis C, I'm urinating blood, and I'm dying of alcoholism. And here I am laying in the back of this abandoned building, and I come out to panhandle. I was wearing these blood-stained soil pants, and I was wearing construction boots, and the right front of the boot was missing. And I had a turtleneck and a black zip-up, kind of like a baseball jacket. And I remember June in New York is kind of like now. It's hot and it's muggy, and I'm cold and sweating at the same time. I don't know I'm going through withdrawal, but that's exactly what was going on. Always clammy, always cold, frail. If I live to be 100, I'll never be as old as the day I walked in here. You know? Now, I'm a cradle Catholic, and somebody just went, huh. it's not that bad. My mom, when I was growing up, albeit she was full-blown alcoholic and narcotic user and had mental health issues, she would teach me about this loving God, this caring God, all things are possible with God, and good things are going to happen if you follow God. And I'm laying in this abandoned building. I'm a drunken bum, literally a drunken bum. Where's this God she was talking about? I'm not too thrilled about him. I was never an atheist. I never doubted the existence of this God, but he ain't interested in my life. In fact, if he is, he's pretty punitive. How did I land here? My mom committed suicide when I was 14 years old, and my dad was like a gangster, and he and I never got along growing up. I says, where's this God you're talking about? So here I am, you know, panhandling, doing all these things, and my life changed. I didn't see it coming. See, I can't see my alcoholism on most days making its way towards me if I'm not spiritually fit. If I'm spiritually fit, I say, oh, I hear what's going on. I can't see God making his way and about to give me an upheaval in my life, even sober. But that was about to happen. For a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would talk about how I surrendered on June 23rd, 1988, but the truth is true until we discover a new truth. I didn't even have the ability to surrender, the insight to surrender, the passion to surrender, the willingness to surrender. I was at the end of the ropes. I hit the wall. There was no room left, no options. It was a free fall with no rungs to grab onto. And God's mercy surrendered me. I didn't see it happening. But here I was in this hallway, and I meant to get up off the floor. I'm vibrating, I'm shaking. I need a drink. I need to get whiskey now. I like to eat Valium back then when I drank whiskey, depending on how much money I can pan up. I need whiskey right now. And it would come to in the shakes. And I got up off the floor, and it would be as if someone hit me from behind the knees, because the knees went out, and down I go. This experience I was about to have didn't sound godly, look godly. I didn't smell godly. It wasn't godly from my point of view. But we live life forward and understand it backwards. It was all God orchestrating the entire thing, removing the last amount of me, the physical, the death of self before the physical death. I had to be completely out of the way, and it takes what it takes. Park Avenue, park bench. We're all going to get there. And it wasn't the beatings I took on the street. It wasn't getting arrested by the police and getting roughed up by them. It was something in here that happens. It's the conversion. This always lies. And something in here knew this was it. And while I'm on the floor, something happened as if something split me wide open. It was like the fist of Gulliver reached down, way down, and pulled out all the poison. And I couldn't stop weeping. I mean, the last time I weeped prior to this was at my mom's funeral. I was 14. I'm 28 now. And you know, when you're in the life, there's no time for emotion. It's you do what you do. You wall up, very stoic. It's survival. And here God split me wide open. I couldn't stop crying. And it wasn't as if my life passed before me, but it felt that way. I remember thinking of my first drink at 14 years old, and how the heck did I get here? This was not the plan. How to become a bum. And I remember thinking, I need to get a drink in me like right now. And if I don't get a drink in me, I'm going to die. I don't know if that would have happened. If I get a drink in me, don't get a drink in me, I'm going to die. I don't know if that would have happened. But that was the feeling that came over me. I was at that jumping off place. I wasn't thinking, I need to make a phone call, get taken to detox, then go to treatment. Then go get a sponsor, do the 12 steps, and on Monday be Moses. That was not the plan. I wasn't thinking about anything to recovery. I had 6 treatment centers prior to the 7th one. I heard about AA. H and I would come in, and I watched the Father Mountain Chalk Talks. I saw the 12 steps on the wall. But this was nowhere near in my vision. I didn't know what I was going to do. Now, back then, if you were a man and talked about God or followed God or a religious man or a spiritual man, I looked upon you as weak and cowardly. As our book says, we look askance at many who claim to be godly. That was me. If you were a man following God back then, you were weak and cowardly. I would see them going into church on a Sunday. What losers. God was for women and children, not for men. Men have to be men. They don't need that kind of crutch. In fact, if God was so loving, why'd he do this to me? And that was the contempt I had prior to investigation. I had no experience with God. And what the mind does is formulate ideas and opinions which keep me in the dark. While I'm sober, by the way, that's what its job is, to manufacture something for me to lock into and pull me away from God. And it had me in its grips back then. But this particular day, that very same God who I mocked and spat at and gossiped and slandered for so long was the only power I could think of to go back to. It was done for me. And in this moment of doubt, in this turmoil that I was in, that all of us get, otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here, whether it's Park Avenue or Park Bench, that very same God, I begged for help. And my exact words were this: please take me from this. I don't want to die. Again, I wasn't thinking about landing here. I just don't want to die. I tried taking my life out there, eating a whole bunch of pills. I didn't want to live for the longest time. It was too painful. And in this moment, I don't want to die. That was enough. That was the catalyst. That was the charge on the battery to jumpstart the engine and get me going. Our 12 steps is having had a spiritual awakening. Biggest promise probably in the big book. It guarantees it, manufactures it. You do this, you'll get that. In our 12 step. But where does it all begin? For many of us, I'm one of them, in that moment of, oh my God, I can't take it anymore. I need to go get some help. That's a shift. My job is to cultivate that by landing in AA and listening to people, what they're telling me to do. When I'm in a place of desperation, where the desperation screams louder than the ego, I'm very teachable at this point. That's what happened to me. I'll share a quick story with you. I get on the streets and I'm just hobbling around. I remember this. I don't know what to do. I'm in panic mode. I don't have the courage, the strength to even walk down the block. Earlier that morning, around 2 or 2:30, my dad was in a town called Atlantic City, New Jersey, with his wife. And they were gambling, watching shows, and, you know, having just a little R&R. Around 2 or 2:30 in the morning, he gets awakened out of his sleep and starts getting dressed. And his wife woke up. She says, "Where are you going?" He says, "I have to find my son, Peter." She says, "Where? We haven't seen him in so long. I don't know." Something he used to call something in his gut. He referred to it in his later years as God. That something woke him up, go find Peter, and he got dressed and headed from Atlantic City, New Jersey to the Lower East Side. Now, that's without traffic, at least a 3-hour drive into the hood. And you know what? God connected the dots, because later that day I'm standing on the corner, tore up from the floor, but my dad drives up and finds me. And the first thing I said when he pulled up, rolled down the window and called my name, the first thing that comes out of my mouth is, "Dad, I'm okay, I'm fine." I just begged a few hours earlier. First thing, alcoholism speaking for me. "It's okay, I'm fine." Thank the good Lord, my dad just got out of the car and walked across the street towards me. This I'll never forget. When he got to me, I went limp. I collapsed. And his hands were under my arms, and he was holding me up. There was nothing left of me. Our roots were about to grasp new soil, and God orchestrated the whole thing. And what he kept repeating, and he wasn't a godly guy back then, "I'm not going to lose my son to this. I'm not going to lose my son to this. I'm not going to lose my son to this," over and over and over again. And all I can be acutely aware of was our close proximity. The last time my dad and I were that close, I was probably 4 or 5 years old, physically that close. With me? We were two ships passing at night, never got along. He avoided me, I avoided him. When we were together, it was an argument, and he argued, I didn't say anything. He's not the type of guy in his day you would even blink in front of. Anyone ever seen the movie Goodfellas? Know that Robert De Niro guy? Yeah. That's my dad. And I'm into long hair, bell bottoms, and hippie beads. And he swore he picked up the wrong baby at the hospital. And off I went to my 7 treatment center. Now, I got to tell you, my journey to hell began, like most of us, innocently, trying to capture an elusive feeling. You know? I had no idea the road I was about to step onto. Now, alcoholism is a symptom of a greater problem. It doesn't come in a bottle of whiskey, but I had the stuff going on prior to it. Well, so do a lot of other kids have that awkwardness when they're growing up, and insecurity. I've heard enough stories, we just seem to take it to another level. You know, if I walked in and Katie said to me, "Nice jacket," and kept walking, I would say, "Oh, thank you," and just not think much of it. I would tell Maren, "What the hell she mean by that?" Then I take a poll. Does this look good on me? I don't know. She said, by the end of the night, Katie said, "That's disgusting. What are you wearing that for?" That's what I do. Now, as a kid growing up, I was a gifted musician. God gave me that gift, a really gifted musician. And, you know, my friends were playing with G.I. Joes, and I was listening to The Doors, and then 10 years after, and the Rolling Stones, and I knew all the players were. And I was on this path for music, and I was the kid in the neighborhood who was going to make it out. Yeah? But there were a lot of things going on in my life that were not pleasant. Around ages 8 to 10, I was being touched inappropriately for a while. It was a secret, who you talk to. In fact, the predator said, "If you tell anyone, bad things are going to happen to me." Is you keep your mouth shut, and you endure it. My dad and I didn't get along. My mom took her life when I was 14. I show up to a street corner in Brooklyn. We used to do back in Brooklyn in the day, is everyone hung out on street corners and drank, the older guys. It was a cool time. You had Motown and rock and roll. You can't beat that. You know, little transistor radio and drinking cold 45 beer in the summertime. There'd be 30, 40, 50 people hanging out, guys and girls, and just having a really good time. I wanted to be like that. I worked my way up into the, you know, as a pecking order to hang out with these men, these worldly guys who were like 17. I had to get in there. And one night I grabbed a quart of beer and I began to drink, and little by slowly I started to experience a sense of ease and comfort the book talks about. I had no idea I was gonna have a life stuck in more, or the craving. I need more. I got to get more. I'll pay any price tomorrow to seek comfort right now. I'll do that in sobriety. I'll pay any price tomorrow to seek comfort right now. They call sex sprees, food sprees, money sprees, gambling sprees, sprees. I didn't know that was about to happen to me. I just love the effect produced by drinking cold 45 beer. Halfway through a quart, I'm feeling wonderful. The girls got prettier. They all wanted me. I got to be about 6'2". I was like Snoop Dogg meets Al Pacino rolled into one. And it was wonderful. The music got better. I loved the effect produced by it. I finished a quarter beer and I'm heading home. And I know drunk. I'm touching drunk for the first time. I feel drunk. I'm drunk. I love drunk. This is wonderful. I never want to be sober again. And the idea of walking into school on Monday morning sober was frightening. I remember thinking, why'd I wait so long? What a long journey it's been. I'm 14. I'm never being sober again. Now, I will tell you, just to show you a little bit of my journey, my first 6 months in Alcoholics Anonymous was Looney Tunes. Going to meetings, not drink, holding my breath. That's basically what it comes down to. Acting out a lot of ways, and I all of a sudden, this eating disorder that I pick up and no one knows about it. Because that's what I do. Left untreated, just sober, is painful. I'm suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience would conquer. My book tells me that. That's a clear-cut warning. I had no experience with the spirit. I had no soul muscles. I was getting no soul food. I was anemic. And yet I'm looking to do this long journey, so it wasn't going to happen. But my first drunk, I loved the effect produced by it. I woke up, I remembered everything, no hangover, and I ran back to the corner the following weekend to capture the elusive feeling. And I chased that to jails and institutions, not knowing what was about to happen about this allergy, this craving, and this mental obsession. Had you ever heard of words like spiritual malady? It sounds like Latin. I don't know what that means until I got here. And my drinking assumed more serious proportions, and I started to take things that didn't belong to me. I'm an alcoholic. I like money, but I don't want to work. If you tell civilians that, they say, what are you talking about? We always laugh. I mean, and by the time I'm like 18-ish, I'm getting in trouble a lot. I sold my drum set, which was like getting rid of like a part of me for money. My music career started to crash and burn. All the appointments I had, I was a no-show a lot of times. And my family thought a lunacy commission should be appointed for him, 18, 19. And I made the big mistake of stealing from my dad. This is not a good thing to do. And I took some of his checks and I forged them. I didn't know anything about checking statements. They all came back. I thought when you cash a check, it vanished into space. No one knows about it. And he got a hold of him. He came looking for me and he found me on the street. And in a short time, I was in my first treatment center. I didn't concede it to my innermost self. I'm an alcoholic. My dad caught me stealing, and so rather than deal with him, I would do this thing in the hospital. I did the 28-day, 30-day thing. I mean, when he caught me, the very first thing I did was blame the girl in the car. She's a bad influence on me. I blamed the guys I was hanging out with. And they're too old for me, they're too mature. And then I threw out the trump card, and mom died, I'm all mixed up. He said, I know that, I'm putting you in this hospital. They'll fix kids like you. And I was discharging drunk in an hour. I romanced a drink for 28 or 30 days. In fact, it's really unbelievable. Many times in treatment, not only was I romancing a drink, I was romancing the life out there, the street, who's doing what? What's happening where? And pull me out the door a few times. I make my second, third, and fourth, and fifth treatment center. So I'm gonna speed this up because I know it's really hot in here and you guys are enduring me. Fifth treatment center. By the time I get into my fifth treatment center, I got holes in my arms. I got an abscess the size of that map right there in my arm. I got the hepatitis. I'm in serious trouble here. I'm not employable. My family does not know what to do with me. My dad would throw me out and take me back in. My brother threatened to kill me with a gun one time. He's, before the drug dealers kill you, I'll kill you and go to jail for this, make it quick. That's what my family was brought to. That's what my alcoholism does to people. And I go into my fifth treatment center, you know, the 30-day thing is not gonna work for you, we wanna hold on to you. Now, when you're in treatment, they wanna extend you, it's like a death sentence, because I'm already planning my getaway. And they held on to me in this fifth treatment center for 9 consecutive weeks. With me? 9 consecutive weeks. Now, when you're in an inpatient lockdown treatment center, well, you know you're not doing good when your side of the door does not have a doorknob. That's not a good sign. So after 9 weeks, I put on weight, I'm bathing, I'm shaving, I'm eating, I'm going to group, I'm going to gym, the physical fitness, yeah, crackheads, junkies, and winos detoxing, go play basketball. I mean, it's not. And 9 weeks, I'm in there and they discharge me. I think I'm gold. Because all I'm looking at is I got color back in my face, I put on a couple of pounds, you know, I look human, and I would judge everything on the external as a barometer for how I'm doing. You know, like the second half of the first step, that Elijah had become unmanageable. Where I fell for that was, well, I was a homeless bum. Now I have a job. I have a little AA car that goes from 0 to 60 in 3 days. Remember those things? And got the little AA girlfriend. I got clean clothes on. My life's manageable. And I'm focusing on purely external things to remedy this thing in here that only God's hand can fix. And then the first half of the first step bites me every time, because it tells me, you're drinking, Pete. And so I get discharged on a Saturday, and it took me 2 days. I went back to my dad's house. And when I walked in the house, my two younger brothers were in the kitchen. And the middle guy sees me walk in and says, what is he doing here? He's gonna ruin everything. You know that look we get from family members when we show up? Just total disgust. I was appalled that he felt that way. 2 days later, it was a Monday morning, I stole a car that didn't belong, I took a car that didn't belong to me. I had a drink. I couldn't take 2 days away from alcohol out there with no design for living. White knuckle sobriety. And I'll pay any price tomorrow to seek comfort right now. And I left really early in the morning. And for me, I met my demons eyeball to eyeball. Because when I got to the liquor store in downtown Brooklyn, New York, everything was still closed. And I had a plan. It was to set up an ambush that my alcoholism does. I was gonna get one little pint of whiskey, get in the car and bring it back, ditch it, and go home to my dad's house and chill. This is gonna be great. When I got there, everything was closed. So I stopped walking up and down on the sidewalk. I'm pacing. And I'm getting more agitated and more frustrated and more nervous and more anxious as the minutes were ticking off the clock. Have you ever had the obsession so loud it begins to feel physical? I'm feeling like I'm going through withdrawal, like I really need a drink. My body did not need a drink. 9 weeks in treatment, I'm physically sober. Once we're physically sober, we can't get any more physically sober. But the head is another story. That's where the main problem centers. It doesn't care how long I'm sober. Thank the good Lord, I'll be 36 years sober in June. You think my alcoholism is even impressed? It'll try even harder. So the liquor store finally opened. I ran and I got a pint of whiskey. One of those swanky joints where it's got the bulletproof glass and you put your money underneath. I got a pint of whiskey, ran outside, and I drank it. You know what happened? I never made it to the car. Because for some reason with folks like us, the second drink screams louder than the first one. I needed a second pint of whiskey. I'm not getting out. I'm not getting away. I wasn't a big bar room drinker. I've heard enough stories. I gotta get home after this one. After this one. We can't get out. Non-alkies don't get that. You can't, I gotta get out, I want to get out, I must get out, I can't. Because the alcohol is calling me. I'm in the craving, I'm in the obsession, I got no God to lean on. It owns me. So I got a second pint of whiskey. I don't know what happened to that car. I went on one of the worst drunks ever. I stopped panicking because I ran out of money. I'm copping Valium, I'm drinking, and I won a debacle that was really a bad one. And I landed my sixth treatment center, and I walked out after 36 hours. Because what burst upon me in that detox time and that kind of foggy way God cuts right through that, the truth will always find me. The same way sinfulness is always going to find me, the truth will always locate me. Just a matter of when, and it did, in 36 hours in the sixth treatment center, and it burst upon me, there's no way I can get out from under. I realized the pain and misery I brought to my family, and that I am a bum. Who am I kidding? And when I walked out after 36 hours, I wound up in some flea bag motel in New York, and that's where I tried to take my life. I ate a whole bunch of pills. I wanted out. This is a mistake. Sobriety is for those people who have jobs, have some money, who've gone to college, as the head's telling me. But not for you. And albeit it sounds a lot of self-pity, but I was under it. And death looked like a good way to go. That's what alcoholism loves. Wants me dead, settle for me drunk. And God interrupted my death because June 23rd, 1988 showed up. I was on the streets for a while. It was not pretty. My first night on the streets, I don't know what to do. I don't know where to lay my head tonight. I'm hungry, I need a drink, what do? I saw panhandling, I'd never panhandled before. I learned how to panhandle, I learned how to steal. I learned how to lie, cheat, manipulate really, really good. All for one thing, to get more alcohol. That's it. I used to curse people as weaklings going to, like, you see them in their backyard having barbecues on a Sunday. Yet I wanted that in the worst way. I'd be, drifting through the streets on a Sunday morning, and I see these people going into the coffee shop with the Sunday newspaper, a bag of bagels, a coffee, embracing the day. It's Sunday, their day off, and they're probably going back to their family. And the hate I had for those people, coupled with how come I can't be like that. It's never gonna happen for me. I wasn't getting sober to get a girlfriend back or get a job back. I just wanted some ease and comfort. And they get to Alcoholics Anonymous, they tell me you wanna get better or feel better. I said, I wanna feel better, wrong answer. We gotta get better in order to feel better. I'm seeking comfort, I'm seeking things that I think are gonna make me comfortable. It might be the very things that get me drunk. What I need to be seeking is God above all things, God all the time. Have constant contact, conscious contact with God. This whole thing for me is about, where am I with this relationship called God? And the 12 steps take me right there. You know what the third step says? We keep close and performers work well. You know what the awakening was? He was always there. There's no distance between me and this creator. It feels, Chuck Hamlin said, conscious separation. It feels like I'm here and God's out there. And we wake up one day and find out God's closer to my own breath. He was there all along, including the abandoned building. I just got out of the way. He's been there. And the 12 steps remove what's in the way to me and God. That doesn't feel comfortable. I'm locked into a lot of things and God just removes it. 36 years sober, God's not done. Thank you, God. But I need to be talking about this power. I need to be talking about this book. Because if I stop talking about what I believe in, I stop believing in it. Yeah. And sometimes I still feel like I'm standing alone. And I'm exhausted chasing God. I feel like I'm standing alone. Where are the other God people? Where are the other big book people? And it feels like I'm standing alone. And then I open up my eyes and it goes on forever. A book talks about we're standing on the firing line. We're going to be on the firing line. In the infantry, those soldiers on the firing line draw fire. I'm going to draw fire. But I got God's armor on. I haven't got hit yet. And so I get into the 7 treatment center, and about 10, 12, 14 days in Long Island, New York, and they sent me out to Minnesota, and I was brought to a meeting called the Three Legacies meeting. Huge meeting on a Friday night. Everyone suited up, and they talked about living in all three sides of the triangle, the importance of that to be in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. I needed to be on your team. I was pinned up against the back of the wall wearing my brother's clothes. I was embarrassed. They didn't fit. It's cold out. I don't have winter clothes. And I would come, I would write on every word you said. I would watch you guys. Who's shacking up in the kitchen? I know there's an angle here. Who's got that money? Somebody's taking a piece. I'm from New York. You always get a piece. None of this is going on. My ride one time says we're going to go to the diner after the meeting, and I went into panic mode because I had lint in my pockets. I don't have money. And he said something to me. I've always shared this. It resonated deeply with me because for me it was a very New York kind of expression. And I says, I don't have money. He says, it's okay. You're with us now. And we had the meeting in the car before the meeting and the meeting in the car after the meeting. We went to the diner. They ordered for me. They gave me something to go home with. And one night in the diner, they gave me a little AA coin at the table. And I got back to my sober house and I put it on my dresser drawer, got on my knees like you told me, and I prayed, thank you, God, for another day. And I got into bed, not a cloud on the horizon. End of a perfect day, yeah? Put my head on the pillow and alcoholism was not done with me. It started talking. You know, if I let it, give it some room, it takes some more room. Once I retreat, once I recede, it's really difficult to bring the line back again. That's why I need God, because that line ain't moving. In fact, I'm going to take that other power's territory. But on my own, I keep retreating and keep retreating and keep retreating. I can't come back. Who are you kidding, Pete? These people live in Minnesota. They're smarter than you. They have jobs. They talk funny. You sound like a Neanderthal as soon as you open your mouth. You're from Brooklyn. What do you got to offer the world? And it's getting louder and louder and louder. I need a drink. And this is what I did. I got, this is going to sound terribly corny. I got out of bed, walked over to the nightstand, a dresser drawer, not a nightstand, got the coin and tucked it under my pillow. I made the most sincere prayer and I learned a lesson. The intent at which I pray, the intent at which I do this work really is what matters. I don't want to be a mechanic. I still want to be a mechanic. It means nothing. I'm looking for transformation, not just information. I don't want to be programmed by a program. I want to find God. And I put that thing, that coin underneath my pillow, and I prayed so hard, Father, please keep me safe and protected, because if I walk out the door, we both know I'm not coming back. I woke up the next morning in that bed, sober. And that stayed with me, knowing that I'm known by my Creator, that He hears my heart. Even now, He knows my soul. And it's that little voice that I got to pay attention to that cuts through all the noise. Am I awake enough to hear that? For me, just going to meetings and not drinking, I'm probably going to be drunk eventually. I get to awaken to that, and then I have the realization, the aha moment, who I'm praying to. That this great power has given me time in the morning to hear me and to listen to me and to steer me and guide me like a mama with her baby. Nothing's getting in front of her. Nothing's getting to that baby without mama. Well, I got this really big God. I don't need a bigger God, by the way. I just need a smaller me. And that family, little by slowly, was reassembled. My dad was in the hospital. We knew he was on a short time. And I just couldn't believe it. It was just devouring me, and I'm trying to keep that AA game face. And I went in to see him. No one was in there, and he was sitting in a wheelchair, slumped over. And my dad, proud man, he tried to, you know, fix himself. And we talked a little bit, and he said, would you do me a favor? I don't want to call the orderly. I'm embarrassed, he said. Can you put me in the bed? So I try to make light of it and kid around and spare him from any further shame. And something happened. I leaned over into the wheelchair. He was really frail. And for some reason, I put my hands under his arms to lift him. And I had this moment on the Lower East Side when he found me. He leaned over and put his hands under my arms to lift me because there was nothing left of me. God allowed me to be there in this difficult moment with some grace and some dignity and bring some grace and dignity to my old man who I adore. I miss him terribly. When I travel, and I travel a lot, on Monday, because I get home Sunday, on Monday at noon, without fail, my phone would ring and me and my dad, welcome home, like I went to Timbuktu. How was your conference? Did Marion go with you? How was your flight? Just conversation. Monday at 12, the phone would ring, welcome home. I haven't gotten that call since July. But in that moment, I lifted my dad up this way and I tucked him in bed and we just talked a little bit. I made a prayer And it was the last time I saw him. He passed about a week or 10 days later. I know it was going to happen because they had to ship him up to New Jersey. This AA life, I don't have a life. That sounds terribly lame, if you knew. Scripture says, if I try to find my life, I will lose. If I lose for his sake, I will find it. Yeah, I don't have a life. It belongs to God. It belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that reason, I suddenly have this full and abundant life. I have a purpose. I have a direction I'm heading on. I get to travel light on most days. I'll close with this. The only thing that God wants from me, and still does, is my soul. Yeah? I give him my soul, and he gives me a life. I give him my life, and he gives me purpose and direction. I've given him my sinfulness over and over and over again, and he continues to give me forgiveness. I've given him my drunkenness, and he's given me sobriety. I've given him my sobriety every day on bended knees. And he continues to give me the sacred rooms called Alcoholics Anonymous. Because every time I walk into a meeting of AA and I say, my name is Peter, they always say hello back. And for this, I'm overpaid and overblessed. So I chop wood and carry water and pass this message on for fun and for free. And for this, I'm forever grateful. Katie, I love you. That's all I got for you.